The quorum.
Or vice chair.
They let anybody in here, don't they?
Let's open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today is Thursday, March 9th. I'm going to open a public hearing, first on HCR 14, and ask Rep. McEwen and Senator Roblin to join us. And then we're going to double up with Senator Roblin. But do you want to finish this one first?
We can finish this one.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you, sir. What a gentleman.
Hopefully.
Your mother trained you
yes,
well.
Yes, exactly.
You have something on there. It's...
We were confused, too, and I didn't understand why she would do that.
But. Chair Clem, I thought you might take notice of that.
There's a Go Ducks thing on her... That's horrible.
It is.
Why would we do that?
I just want to make note of that.
They fired our native son. How could you?
In April, I will proudly wear my orange. I'm actually a graduate of Oregon State, Chair Clem.
I'm going to wear a black ribbon for poor Mark Helfrich. That's what I'm going to do today. Okay, anyway, tell us about Tom.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee, my name is Kattie McEwen. I represent House District 9, Coos Bay to Yahats, almost to Elmira. I'm very proud today to bring this resolution before you, honoring someone for whom I have the utmost respect. His name is Tom Rumreich. Tom Rumreich is one of those gentlemen who, I guess you could call him an unsung hero, certainly in my community and I think regionally and across the state. The first time I became aware of Mr. Rumreich, I was a school board member in Coos Bay, and I wandered into Blossom Gulch Elementary School into a classroom, and I looked around to visit with the children a little bit, and I saw on every desk a little glass bowl that had a fish in it. And each of these children had named their fish. The egg had hatched on their desk. The little smolt was ready to go be put into the creek, and when the day was right and Mr. Rumreich blessed the timing, the children all walked out from Blossom Gulch Elementary School and put their little fish into Blossom Gulch Creek. And about 3 or 4 years later, they watched those salmon come back up the creek. And he did some remarkable work. The program now involves upwards of 5,000 elementary to high school students every year in Coos County. In 36 years with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Tom passed on the knowledge and skills that he had to participate in fisheries to classrooms full of children of all ages in our district. The work was critical and to the continuing development of our fisheries and their related industries. And Tom, in our little corner of the world, truly has become an icon. 5 days after graduating from Oregon State, with a degree in fisheries science, Tom was hired by ODF&W, and when the Salmon and Trout Enhancement Program, the STEP program, which many of you are very familiar with, was created via legislation in 1981, Tom was there and ready to step in. The STEP program under Tom's leadership sustained the growth of the fishing industries in Coos Bay and along the coast to the tune of millions of dollars in economic impact, not to mention the educational value that was invested in our youth because of the work that he did. I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. In 1982, we had about 200 Chinook salmon harvested in the Coos Bay Estuary. In 2011, 11,000 Chinook were harvested, and STEP was credited with 81% of that increase. Last year, 2.3 million fall Chinook were released into Coos River. 2 million of those were raised with the assistance of STEP volunteers under the guidance of Tom Rumreich at the Morgan Creek Hatchery. He's been instrumental in the construction of the Millicoma Interpretive Center, hatcheries on Morgan Creek and Noble Creek, the capture and release sites at local elementary and high schools, and the naming of the Rumreich Hatchery on Morgan Creek in his honor is a fitting tribute to the years of energy and creativity and hard work and expertise that Tom has put into this state. You'll find in the electronic record written support from several Coos Bay constituents. He leaves behind a legacy as a biologist, as a manager, as an educator. And in Southern Oregon, this gentleman truly is iconic. And I would ask that you join Senator Roblin and me and support us in our efforts at the request of our constituents to honor Mr. Rumreich with this resolution.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee. My name is Arnie Roblin. I'm senator from Senate District 5, which includes parts of 7 counties, Coos, Douglas, Lincoln, Lane, Tillamook, Polk, and Yamhill counties. And There are few people who I would put on the kind of pedestal that I put Mr. Rumrick. Having worked at the high, in the schools for the pretty much the same time that he was there, he transformed education with respect to understanding the life cycles of salmon and all of those things with thousands of children from all over Oregon. We have buses that come in from Grants Pass and from Medford and all those other places to come to the hatchery at Morgan Creek. And when we were finding it difficult to get the salmon managed with step and other kinds of stuff, he went out to all the timber industry people and said, you need to be a part of solving the problem of having fish in our streams. And they actually built, we bought this particular Morgan Creek hatchery, and in doing so, they built a classroom out there for kids to come in and get a real understanding of fish. And if you look at the films and the pictures of kids standing in these ponds where the fish come up to, grasping onto salmon and collecting them as they go, put them through the process of taking the eggs and then getting those eggs fertilized and then back in the creek, it is something that transforms the lives of kids. And as we talk about, you know, outdoor school and all those other kinds of stuff, this was one experience of an outdoor experience that thousands of children got to know. And I always felt that as a high school principal, I had the opportunity to touch a lot of lives. But I will tell you that Rumrick touched more lives than I ever did, because the number that came there from all over the state to get their hands on fish, to understand how the process works, to make sure that kids understood what we had to do to make sure that those salmon keep coming up our rivers, unparalleled, in my opinion, in fish and wildlife or any place else. I've worked with him. I just thought he was a part of a fixture of what we had in our community. And the people who got into STEP and the thousands of people that helped make these things happen, he organized it and made it work. There are hundreds of people in Fish and Wildlife and other agencies and other places around who this became a reason for them to get into high school education and then to go on and make it a career, because they got a taste of it. Then they got to come up and help the elementary kids. And then, I mean, it was just part of what they did. And it engaged them so much that they came back to high school and decided, I've got to do these other things that I don't particularly like, maybe math or other kinds of things, because I want to be able to make a difference for Oregon and all of us with respect to our salmon populations. When we had the dedication of the building and all of the people, it is an eclectic group of everybody in the community. There is no one that is left out of his sphere of influence, because he needed everybody to make it all work. And when you find those, we're really nervous. I mean, I'll tell you that we're nervous about Fish and Wildlife. We're nervous about all these other people, that we're going to have someone of his caliber to replace him as a fish biologist there and really know the influence. The little stream that we talk about, I was working with a group of people in a nonprofit, and we wanted to have an outdoor experience for our Blossom Gulch kids that's in the middle of town. And we built this trail that's out in the back, and you can see old trees that were harvested back in the 1800s and all sorts of stuff, the old stumps that are left there. And they have this really great trail. And they decided, through Rumrick and a lot of people's help, that we should build a pond back there, and they could put their fish in when they did this little fish experiment every year. And it was amazing. No one expected the fish to come back, because what you don't know is that Blossom Creek is a really great little creek that comes down, but right at Blossom Gulch, it goes underground. So it goes for about a mile from Blossom Creek all the way down to a tide gate at the waterfront. And no one really thought the fish were going to swim for a mile underground to get back to this little deal. So they dumped their fish in. And now there's a really cute little fishery for families right at right down on the waterfront, where people stand around that tide gate because the fish back up until the tide gate opens, and you can catch salmon. With a little pole and your family, you can sit on the beach and catch salmon at that place, because now they do go up that. We call them our urban salmon. We're trying to show people that these salmon are resilient. They'll do just about anything they have to get back home. And it's an amazing experience and a community thing, and it's all of those little connections that he made with elementary kids in our community on a regular basis, and elementary and high school kids from all over the state on a more irregular basis, depending on whether they got the money to bring the field trip over. But truly a person who made a difference in the lives of our kids and a lot of Oregonians. And I, along with Caddy, commend you this HCR to memorialize this really great Oregonian. Thanks.
And Chair Clem, if I may, very, very briefly, two things. When he set up the education program for kids, he would start with them in first grade with their little egg on the desk that would hatch. Then when they get to be about third grade, they would go up to the hatchery and they'd clip fins, so they would mark the fish that were being put back in the river. Mm-hmm. And then when they get to be bigger, because they have to be big to wrestle the salmon, they'd bring them back up in sixth grade or so and allow them actually to put waders on and get in the hatchery, wrestle the salmon so they could harvest eggs and fertilize them. So the kids got it all the way along. And then he had the remarkable ability to tag children who he saw had particular abilities. And there's a young man right now that is a protege of Tom's at Willamette University who came through Tom's program, ended up volunteering with Tom at Morgan Creek mm-hmm. as a high school student to help with the education program, got so excited about fish. He ended up going to Oregon State University, getting a degree in fish biology. He's a fish geneticist. And now he's at Willamette University getting a degree in public policy, and he will be here in this building one of these days because of his dedication and his passion for fish that Tom was able to cultivate. So he touched many, many people in many ways, let alone the economic driver of just having a really robust fishing industry in our coastal community. So I just wanted to add that, sir.
Okay. Any questions for our colleagues? We've just got one person to go. Do you have 3 minutes to wait to do first purchase? Okay,
I'm
Shannon,
fine.
Do you want to come up and we'll just wrap this one up now and then get back to Senator Roblin to kick us off on this next bill?
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. On behalf of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission and the Department of the Fish and Wildlife, I want to thank you for hearing House Concurrent Resolution 14, which recognizes Tom Rumright and his contributions to Oregon fisheries. Unfortunately, Director Melcher is unable to be here today, but he did want me to express his sincere appreciation to Representative McEwen, Senator Roblin, Representative Boone, Representative Gomberg, and Representative Smith for their efforts in developing this resolution. Tom Rumrek did serve 37 years as our Salmon Trout Enhancement Program biologist for the department. He started with the program at the inception and built a program in Coos Coquille 10-mile district from the ground up that has been a model for outdoor recreation and outdoor education and community involvement. Tom has received many honors and awards over his career, but one of the most meaningful was in 2015 when he received recognition for educating over 100,000 students through the STEP program. And I have been able to work in that community and with Tom, and I can tell you it's exceptional in that community that you can ask any child to tell you what a salmon is, and they can describe the salmon life cycle. They can tell you how important it is to have clean water and healthy fisheries. You can go many places when you start with that high level of knowledge in that community. So again, we just want to thank you for considering this today.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 14 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2099. And Senator Roblin, would you like to come up? I wanted you especially because this bill, I think, has a committee bill name on it, but it's a copy of one of your bills from the past, and I thought you could tell us a little bit about it. Then we've got panels pro and con to go later.
Thank you very much. And again, for the record, Arne Roblin, Senate District 5, Coos Bay to Yahats and over to Fall City and Sheridan. And that. So this bill really brought me to the legislature, just so you know. I was on the water board in Coos Bay, Oregon, and one of the issues we had was a 10-mile creek water right that we had. And we were working on that water right and getting it, trying to get it perfected, and we were in a lawsuit with the city of Lakeside, and 1,000 friends joined in. And so we'd won at the lower court, and it was in appeals. And in the appeals court, they brought up the fact that we had a water right for 10 Mile Creek, and we had not perfected it. And we said, that's true. And they said, well, you only have, I think it was 5 years then, 3 to 5 years to perfect it, and it's 5 years is up. You haven't perfected it, so you're going to lose. And we did lose at that court case. And our comment was, we've been in litigation the whole time. We couldn't do anything. And they said, well, that's not in the statute as an example of an excuse why you shouldn't perfect it. So we couldn't perfect it because we were in a lawsuit where we couldn't perfect it, but by not perfecting it, we lost the water right. So it was exceedingly frustrating for me sitting on a water board to see that happen. And so one of the first things that I did was get involved with House Bill 3038 back in 2005 to change that and to say if we as a state are expecting people to plan for a 20-year horizon, then municipalities and water boards and those should have at least a 20-year horizon to work at water. Because if you don't get water ahead of time, you will not get it later. Most of the surface water is already
committed,
spoken for. A number of years ago, Fish and Wildlife took just about everything else that was left that was not already attributed to because they wanted it for fish. So there was a need for real conversations about how does cities, if we're growing, and truthfully we do, Coos Bay has grown slowly. And as a water board member, we built the last dam that was built for a water deal. We tripled our water capacity. And during this, probably the biggest drought we've had in a long time, we had more water in our reservoir at the end of this time when this rain started coming than we used to even hold in our old reservoir. So we solved the problem for our community, at least for the short term. So that was a big issue. And so when I get to the legislature, we start having these conversations, and we finally come to an agreement with a lot of people sitting in a room with 3038. It passes, and the agency in charge of it puts out some rules. It was really great. It was moving along just fine. About the same time, lawsuit from the Environmental Committee on the bill, basically saying that it didn't deal with this fish persistence, and which was a surprise to a whole lot of us because we didn't know that fish persistence was a big part of the conversation, though it was probably there. I will tell you that I try to search my brain, and I can't think of a lot of times about it. But it wasn't, from my perspective, what was the rules that were made by Water Resources and others were appropriate. They followed the letter of what we thought, at least I thought, had come out of 3038. After a number of years, I think it was 2013, the court finally made a decision on it and said that no, and in fact, they had not followed what the intent of the bill was, because they didn't have fish persistence entered into the rulemaking. That was a surprise to me, but as I look over the court case, I understand why. There was a senator who was also on that work group who carried the bill in the Senate. His name was Senator Ringo. And in his floor speech, he made a big conversation about fish persistence as being a part of the conversation. When the court made their decision, if you go and read the court decision, you will find that the decision is based on legislative intent. So what you say on the floor can mean a lot when it gets to court, because there wasn't anything in the bill necessarily, but there was, by one of the carriers in the Senate, a legislative intent that the court used to say that the Water Resources had made the rules incorrectly. In the meantime, Water Resources had sent out rules, and they had told people, here's the rules, here's what you're going to do. And so cities, municipalities, water boards, all were starting to work on trying to get their permits renewed. They had stopped doing the permitting for a while, so there was a big backlog of deals waiting for the outcomes of some of this stuff. And so when they started going again after 2005 to start issuing those licenses, instead of doing it like they have always done it in the past, i.e., first in, first out. So if I have put in a water right, I'm in a line, and they just go through one after another. But it says there was a big backlog. They thought it would be easier for the organization to do it by watersheds, because there were a whole lot of them in each of the watersheds, and the research necessary to make decisions would be better if we did it at a watershed at a time. So they started doing that by watersheds, and the lawsuit went on. In 2013, the answer came from the Supreme Court. Not all of those backlog had been done. Most of them had. But they put it back to 2005. So some of the people who were early on in the process because of their watershed already had their permits, and they were okay. A whole bunch of others who may have, in fact, I do not know this for certain, turned their request for a hearing and a new permit before the people who got them were left out because they were later in the process. My belief when we started having the conversations the last couple of years, and I've been involved in these, was that we should try to be fair. We set up something. Our agency made a decision about that same, how to implement that. They went about it in a way that was efficient to get it done, and it shouldn't matter to you if you were in the watershed that was last as opposed to the watershed that was first. Those rules should at least be able to pertain up until the court case was done in 2013. What your bill does here is it says that's the way it should be. That's the fair way. Wait till 2013. All the ones that were done before are done. In 20 years, we can have that conversation again. Other people will, I'm sure, will say that they should have known because this stuff was going on and there was issues. But from my perspective, and that's and mine alone, I believe that the intent and the way in which it was handled should have led to a decision that any of those people that were in that, for me, anybody who was in there getting a permit deal should not have to be terminated because they were at the wrong end of the line when it came to making these new permits. This bill does a pretty good job of getting to that point, and I encourage you to support this bill for those reasons. And I look forward to hearing all the testimony from other people who may have a different perspective of where it is, and I accept that because the reality of everything is the perception that you bring to the table with you. But I was, as I say to myself, and I've told my staff before, we need to watch as any bill goes through, because I was schooled on the idea of legislative intent in a way that I didn't think I would be, but I was. Mm-hmm. And I was very new. I was my freshman year here when I first got involved with 3038. And it has persisted from then to now. We continue to talk about the same issues from me to the legislature a long time ago. Any questions? I would be glad to answer.
Questions for Senator Roble. Rep. McKeon.
Just a really quick one. Arnie, there are two amendments.
I haven't looked at them.
Oh, okay. I'd like to know what you think about the two amendments.
I encourage you to talk to the people who brought those in the counties and cities who have been actively involved in this for the last couple of sessions. When we tried to come to an agreement last time, I didn't really particularly like it. I tried to force an agreement that, anyway, other people didn't particularly like it.
We'll be reaching out to see what you think about the amendments. Thank you.
And enjoy the opportunity you get to understand more about water policy and Oregon and making sure that we do the right things, because to allow our municipalities, our water boards, and others to try to do the right thing for the people that they represent. So, thank you.
Any further questions for Senator Roblin? Okay, so we'll start with a panel of proponents for the bill, then we'll go to opponents. Tracy Rutten, Mark Landauer, and Bill King, our mayor from Sandy. And then on deck is Jack Dempsey, Lisa Brown, and Tom Wolf. And Doug Riggs, I don't know what your position is, so I'm just going to put you up after the opposed in case you're neutral. And see Doug here. Oh, he's talking to Arnie. Okay. So tell us more. We've heard Senator Roblin's little history with this bill. I know that you two have been in a work group with the other side, who will talk in a moment, all year long. So tell us about what we need to know.
Thank you. Okay. Good morning, Chair Klein, members of the committee. For the record, Tracy Renton with League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2099. As many of you are aware, this has been a rather long-term discussion. We first introduced legislation in the 2015 session to try and remedy a 2013 Court of Appeals decision that came out. The 2015 session being the first opportunity that we had to introduce a potential legislative fix to what we were surprised in terms of learning that the Court of Appeals interpreted a statute that was adopted in 2005 to have a retroactive application actually all the way back to the 1990s for a number of municipal water right holders. So essentially what that means for our members is a clawback, if you will, of a quantity of water that some municipalities have been using for around 20 years or so, depending on kind of where they played out in the process and where they were in terms of timing from the department in processing their extension paperwork. As you've heard, there's been a lot of uncertainty around this issue. We're talking about decades worth of uncertainty in a process that our members rely upon. We have to make investments in our water supply systems. Our communities do grow, regardless of whether we have the certainty and clarity that we need from the state of Oregon to know what the rules are in terms of how we're treated as municipal water rights and providers of drinking water services. I do want to point out that the Water Resource Department has, I believe, submitted a background document, which I think is actually one of the better documents I've seen that articulates how we landed in this very precarious position and walks through all of the details, the gory details, if you will, of how we got here. I guess what I want to clarify today is, when fish persistence conditions were enacted, which again was in House Bill 3038 in 2005, the Oregon Water Resource Department did adopt rules and provided communication out to our members that those conditions, so the notion of what was the undeveloped portion of their permit, would occur to date, or in other words, on a prospective manner. You'll see, and I believe Mark has submitted a document that's got all of the Water Resource Department, or a number of Water Resource Department rules, including a definition of the undeveloped portion of the permit, as well as some of the documents that they would use, application forms for our members, for instance, that were very clear in saying that as we look at what is developed under your permit and as we move forward on this backlog of permits, what we're talking about is a prospective application. As you heard from Senator Roblin, essentially what would happen is the Water Resource Department, as they work through this backlog, and they did it geographically because it made a, my understanding is it made a lot more sense to work with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and to look at one basin at a time where you've got fish data at that location. So it really wasn't a matter of who had been waiting the longest to have their permits processed. It was about geographic basins. And as they worked through that, they would contact municipalities. And the question at that time, and this is, again, after the legislation passed in 2005, was tell us how much water you've used as of this moment, right now. A municipality would report that water use amount, and then any portion that was not developed would be sent over to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and then they would put conditions on that portion of the permit. And that happened for a number of years following passage of House Bill 3038 in 2005. And then up until the Court of Appeals decision came out in 2013. And again, what that Court of Appeals decision said was, you know, Water Resource Department, we don't think you were doing that correctly. In terms of our interpretation of the statute, the question we think that you should have asked was, how much water were you using the last time you had an approved extension of time for that permit? And that's where all of this uncertainty comes into play. The last time these folks had an approved extension of time was in the 1990s. And the reason being that there were a lot of rule changes and interpretations of how we should go about processing these things, and they were put on an administrative hold. And then you combine that up with the litigation of Coos Bay North Bend, the legislation that passed in 2005, and you have folks that didn't have that certainty, that piece of paper of an approved extension. Again, now since the 90s, I think City of Philomath is the one that goes back the farthest to 1993. So the question becomes, Philomath, how much water were you using in 1993? Any amount that was not developed as of 1993, that's what's going to be sent over to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for them to place conditions. And so that's why we say this is essentially a clawback of water that's been used by communities and that they thought they had every right to be using. I think one of the frustrations from our members is that they feel in this process, and we've had a lot of conversations, and I both thank and apologize to those who have been part of those conversations because they've not been very fun, to be honest. I think we're counting 50 plus hours of time spent trying to come to some reasonable agreement on this. What our members feel is that they follow the rules of the state of Oregon. They had to make decisions about their infrastructure investments. Their communities grew despite uncertainty. And what they're feeling is that if you delve into a case-by-case, file-by-file review, that is not how the state of Oregon typically deals with water right permits. To have the legislature be judge and jury on who deserves the water is a kind of a frightening notion for some of our members. What they're talking about is an administrative process that had a lot of uncertainty, and it failed a lot of our members in many ways. And so it's landed us in a very tricky position. Again, those members of ours that were able to have their extensions processed before the Court of Appeals decision, they got the benefit of the law as it was being applied. Those are final orders. They won't be undone. So those folks are kind of breathing the sigh of relief, going, glad I got in the door before this court decision came down. But it's those other permits that hadn't been really touched for quite some number of time that are going, this doesn't seem fair to us. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. This bill is really critical to provide certainty to our members that rely on the state of Oregon, and it's critical in terms of providing future drinking water supply. In addition, it also ensures that our bond ratings are not adversely impacted. When we go out for bonds to pay for the infrastructure, it's good to know that the water actually will be there when we're dealing with that. So we have concerns over bond ratings in the context of this issue. And I think with that, I'll go ahead and close. Happy to answer any questions. I'll turn it over to Mark Landauer, though.
Rhetorically, so they can answer it, maybe.
Sure. Vice Chair McClain's going to ask something, and they'll let you answer during your testimony.
So I guess what I wanted to know, something that you said was that there are many now who have final orders, and so I'm wondering, out of jurisdictions, how many have the final orders that got through the process before the court case, and how many do not have orders and are vulnerable to the after process?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McClain, I might want to defer to the Oregon Water Resource Department on that, because my understanding is there were several hundred permits after the passage of the legislation in 2005. What we know that when we initially got a list of who may be impacted after the Court of Appeals decision, it was right around 60. Now, the level of impact varies. For instance, you could have a municipality who has a water right and they've developed zero of that water right so far. So they're not, it doesn't matter if you ask them where they were at in 1990 or where they're at today. And then there's others that did some pretty substantial development during that period of uncertainty. So I would suggest the Water Resource Department has the more specific numbers, though.
Okay, please.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 950 districts across the state, 49 of whom are municipal water suppliers. I'd like to give you a little context about how much water we are talking about that is in question as a result of this bill. Water users in Oregon divert about 9 million acre-feet of water on an annual basis. This represents approximately 8% of the estimated 91 million acre-feet of water that the state of Oregon receives each year. Now, a portion of this water is, as mentioned previously, under in-stream water rights. Okay, so there are approximately 1,400 in-stream water rights that protect 19 million acre-feet of water. Again, water users in the state use about 9 million acre-feet of water. And those users include agriculture, self-supplied industry, exempt wells, and then municipal water suppliers. The municipal water suppliers consume approximately 6% of the amount of water that is actually diverted from or is put to beneficial use. Now, municipalities have about 1,600 municipal water rights. Okay, so that 8% of out-of-stream water that is used is under those approximately 1,600 permits. We are talking about a very, very small subset of the municipal suppliers that are caught in this web, if you will. And I believe that the Water Resources Department's information that they have provided gives you a sense of where those communities are and who they are. I will tell you, though, that there's still some uncertainty, okay? There has been quite a bit of work, as the chair knows, with the governor's office and the Water Resources Department on trying to really get a better understanding understanding of the impact. And I believe that we are still unclear on about 23 of the municipals that are caught in this web. But we know for sure that there are some that have an impact, and those communities are listed in the Water Resources Department's material that they have provided. Last year, in 2016, we were able to get a bill passed in the Senate that would have corrected much of the problems. And regrettably, it came to the House on the very last day of session during the 16 session. And at that time, a few members of your body sent a letter to the governor's office asking that the Water Resources Department not process any of these permits that are caught in this challenge. And the Water Resources Department chose not to proceed, which gave us an opportunity to continue to have our discussions with Water Watch. And as Ms. Rutten mentioned, we have spent probably north of 50 hours trying to find a solution to this problem that would meet both parties' satisfaction. And we still haven't quite got there. Water Watch recently provided us a proposal, and unfortunately for us, it would not work. We provided them a counter proposal, and in all fairness, we took some time to review their proposal. They're taking some time to review ours, and I think that's absolutely fair. Whether or not they're comfortable with our proposal, I can't obviously speak for them. We continue to try to find that middle ground, but again, certainty and past investments in this infrastructure is really important consideration. Remember, each of these communities played by the rules that they understood to be in place. The court's decision in 2013 put everybody's understanding of how these permits were to be processed and how fish conditions were to be applied on its head. A couple final remarks. Rep. McEwen asked about the two amendments. I can speak to one. The Dash 1 amendment's intent is to clarify that some of these, well, all of these permits need to continue to have water management and conservation plans. The way the bill is currently constructed, there is a possibility that some of these municipalities could get out from that requirement of putting together a water management conservation plan. The intent of this amendment is simply to make it abundantly clear that all of these communities that are caught in this web will need to develop a water management conservation plan. And finally, most of these municipalities are pretty small. They're largely rural. They don't have a lot of treasure to spend on their water systems. And it really can be a considerable burden for them and for their ratepayers to now suddenly become aware that some of the water that they had planned on and had been using may no longer be available to them. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Let's hear from our mayor first.
Okay. Chair Clem and members of the committee, my name is Bill King. I'm the mayor of the city of Sandy. House Bill 2099 would provide the city of Sandy with the certainty that we need to ensure that we have an adequate supply of drinking water for existing and future needs. The city of Sandy is one of the fastest growing cities in the state of Oregon, and Oregon is one of the fastest growing states in the nation right now. So we've got a plan, and we have, for our future water supplies for our residents. This issue has been incredibly frustrating as it has left certain municipalities, including Sandy, in a disadvantaged position. The city made investments with the understanding that the city's permit would not include fish persistence conditions, but the law change in 2005 means that, contrary to Oregon Water Resources Department's interpretation of its rules, a portion of the city's permit will now be impacted. I want to make it clear to the committee that the city followed all the rules and the guidance of the Oregon Water Resources Department. It's critical that we be able to rely on rules and guidance provided us through the state of Oregon. and through its state agencies, as we are in the position of needing to plan for the future, ensure that we can provide critical services, including drinking water, and feel confident in the investments that we make in our infrastructure. The impacted permit is S-36601. It has a priority date or date of application of 1971. As a city, we've relied on that permit to ensure we have drinking water that can be developed as we grow our population. The last approved extension of time from the Water Resources Department expired in 1996. There's been a lot of uncertainty coming from the state in terms of how municipal permit extensions are to be processed. But despite the uncertainty, our community has continued to grow, as have most of them in Oregon, and we've been able to accommodate that growth. As a result of that growth, we've invested over $1 million in 2002 to expand our water treatment plant capacity, and in June of 2004, we were able to develop and use all the water provided under our permit of 4 cubic feet per second. We had used 75% of this water prior to 1996, but developed the remainder of our permit in 2004. This development all occurred prior to the law changing in 2005. We find it highly disturbing that a law adopted in 2005 could have a clawback effect on our water supply that was developed prior to 2005. It's not right, and it puts our investments and our community at risk. If House Bill 2099 doesn't pass, the city would likely need to buy water from other sources, which would be expensive in terms of purchasing water and getting it to the city. Retroactively reducing our water supply does not mean that we won't need to find the water somewhere. We've demonstrated that we need this water for our community, and that need is not going to change. It's actually going to increase. If this bill doesn't pass, we'd also be sitting on millions in stranded assets that was paid for with public money. We have a fiduciary responsibility to make sound investments, and we ask for your support in protecting the integrity of those investments. We encourage you to the committee to pass House Bill 2099.
Questions for this panel? Vice Chair McLean.
Well, I found the list that you told me about, so thank you very much. I mean, it includes the City of Bend, Southwest Lincoln County Water District, North Clackamas County Water Commission, Tri-City Water District, Philomath, City of Philomath, Cottage Grove, Detroit, Hood River, Lake Oswego, Sandy, and Lakeside Water District. I mean, those are specific ones that people think are part of this conversation. So I guess to the mayor, your request has been to get that extension or to make that permit updated and be, you know, ready to go. So what has been the process that you've been waiting in? Have you been waiting for somebody to contact you? Have you had rules that they've sent to you that said you're in a line? But what is the process of resolving this just even with our own department?
Well, Vice Chair McLean, we're not really waiting for anything. We've developed, and okay, we're currently using all this water.
Okay.
But if this doesn't pass, that can change.
But you still are in line to get your permit updated.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Vice Chair McKeown.
I just want to I'm sorry. Thank you, Chair Clem. This is for the mayor. So Senator Roblin was talking about the process by which people who were trying to perfect their water rights were put in the queue, and it wasn't first in, first out. It was done by watershed. And then the door closed. Some were eliminated from the process.
Yes.
Are you one of those unfortunate municipalities who got stuck when the door closed because of just the way that they put people in the queue?
I don't believe we are, ma'am. we perfected our rights, and we've been using the water since 2004.
Okay.
So I believe we were not in that part of the group.
Okay. But this is still affecting you.
Yes.
Even though you weren't impacted by how the queue was formed.
Yes.
So the two things are going on here then. Thank you.
And if I can provide a clarification,
sure.
Chair Clem, Representative McEwen, to a degree, yes. They are one of those where the door closed, or I suppose what I would say is the court's interpretation changed so dramatically, and that they had not had their permit processed yet. And so they are one of those where, so if, however you want to, you know, describe that, the door did in some way shut on them, where they are not one that was fortunate enough to have a final order prior to that court decision, which went with a retroactive condition. So that they are in that position.
Okay.
That
thank you for the clarification.
Representative Power.
Mayor King, good
yes.
morning.
Good,
good
morning.
To see you. But this question isn't for you. I just wanted to say hello. So I think many of us will appreciate that fairness is a pretty big issue whenever we're passing laws. So no municipalities were aware of this fish persistence until 2013?
Chair Clem, Representative Power. I will clarify one thing that the senator indicated. We knew that fish persistence was in House Bill 3038. My understanding, I was not there at the time, but from talking with folks who were there, they knew that it was one of those last-minute final days of session. This bill's got to get through. What are we going to negotiate here? The language, if you look at the language, and I believe in the document that Mark passed out, we actually highlight this language, was not very clear. In terms of, we still don't really know exactly. There's litigation, quite frankly, on what is fish persistence. Is it long term? Is it short term? What is it? What does it exactly mean? We knew the notion of some conditions were in there. We would have never agreed, and I've been assured from the members that were part of the conversation at the time, to a retroactive application of the conditions for development of water that occurred prior to 2005. Again, what that language fails to say is that they will look at the undeveloped portion, but it doesn't say as of when. And that's really the challenge, is that the department's interpretation following passage of 3038 in 2005 was that is as of the time that we process your extension going forward. So, yes, we did know that was there. There was not a lot of certainty about it. The rules indicated one thing, and then the court overturned that interpretation.
Okay. But I think as of 2005, especially since I heard a senator mention it when he carried the bill,
right.
folks were aware that this was something that was on the table.
Yes, okay. and I will clarify as well, it applied only to the pre-1998 permits that were kind of sitting in this position, if you will, of uncertainty. So, but yes, we did know it was there. Didn't think it was retroactive.
Okay. And then I just follow up.
Yeah.
Okay. What happens if fish persistence is not applied?
Could you clarify your question? I'm not quite tracking what the question is. What if fish persistence is not applied?
Yes.
Applied to?
To the remaining water rights. In your perspective, what happens, you know, in the river if the standard is not applied?
I see.
Yeah, and to fish.
Chair Clem, Representative Power. And again, what we're not asking in the bill that we've introduced to not have fish persistence apply. So I want to make sure that that's clear. What we're wanting to do with our bill is draw a date certain. The date we selected was December 11th, 2013, which is the date of the Court of Appeals decision. We certainly, I think, could have been more greedy in what we asked for in the legislation, but we felt like there was a case to be made to say that that was the date that our understanding of the law got turned upside down, essentially. So I want to make it clear that fish persistence for many of these permits would still apply to the undeveloped portion of those permits. It's just that the undeveloped portion would be determined as of December 11th of 2013. If fish persistence for some reason was determined by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to not be appropriate or to not apply, if let's say they used all the water under the permit prior to December 11th of 2013, it varies. It depends. What that means is that the community used the demonstrated use of the drinking water, and that that water is then protected for that community to continue to use. Again, these are very different permits on very different streams and water bodies. So I guess it would be hard to know what the impact, I guess, if that would be. I'm not sure if I'm understanding. You know, if I'm.
I guess if
follow,
follow up to clarify. So to me, it sounds as though there's a conflict around how. When the fish persistence should start applying to undeveloped water right pieces. The folks who I think we're going to hear from later would like it to apply sooner than 2013. You'd prefer to apply it as late as possible. Under the guise of the first scenario. If we were to apply fish persistence to undeveloped water rights as of 2015, when folks apparently knew that it was on the table, what would happen if it weren't? I mean, I'm hearing you talk about a lot of water in play.
Chair Clem and Representative Power, and again, I will say that it will vary. It varies, I think, because what ODFW is going to tell, and that's part of the problem with these permits, is that when that undeveloped quantity of water goes over to ODFW for their conditions, what we don't know is what ODFW is going to say back to them. There have been scenarios where ODFW says, we don't think there's an issue here, and we don't see it appropriate to have fish persistence conditions. That certainly has happened in some cases, and in some cases that's certainly not what has happened. So again, what we're talking about is that quantity of water. What I will say is that one of the challenges that we've struggled with is that this is not protected water. And so when those conditions come back, it says, hey, community, during certain times of the year, we think the fish need to have this amount of water bypassed. So that would be, for instance, no longer available to City of Sandy to withdraw. There could be a junior water user on that same stream that now just got less likely to be shut off during a time of shortage because the water is not protected for fish. And it's something that we've struggled with. We're not sure how you would go about doing that protection for that water. But certainly there are a number of my members that say if we're going to bypass the water for fish, it ought to be protected for fish. So again, I'll say there's a lot of variability within it. For some folks, what I tend to hear is that fish persistence conditions have resulted in the past in about a 20% to 30% reduction during certain times of the year on that quantity of water that is being conditioned. So about 20% to 30% of that quantity of water being bypassed during certain times of the year.
Vice Chair McLean.
Well, to me, there looks like, as Representative McEwen said, there's two issues. There's, first of all, the process, which to me looks like it needs a big cleanup and has needed a big cleanup for 20 years. So there's that issue. And that is also the fairness issue. But you have scoped it down to, it looks like the difference between the two groups is 2005 to 2013, as far as what is the number or the year or the place where we should actually be making sure that on these undeveloped portions of, and which doesn't, you've developed all yours, but
yes,
on those that have not developed, the undeveloped portion, that we should be putting this fish persistence, quantity or number to. So, I mean, I think that's the debate I want to hear more about, is why 2005, why 2013. 2013, I heard you say fairness, court case, the goalposts changed. We've got people who are affected in a variety of different ways. So I'm going to hear from the next panel, I think, what the 2015 or 2005 is all about. But I really appreciate your energy and your effort, and this sounds like just a horrendous process.
And Chair Clem, if I may, mm-hmm. Representative Vice Chair McLean, what I will say is it's a challenging position, especially for the League of Oregon Cities to be in, because if we drew a 2005 date, I know I have members of mine, one of them sitting to my right, that's going to breathe a really big sigh of relief. I'm going to have other members that between 2005 and 2013 thought they had every right to continue to invest in their water supply and develop that water. And if we draw a line at 2005, I'm going to have some happy members and some that say, whoa, that's really not the right call for our community. So it's a challenging position for us to try and negotiate in.
And we need to hear it from the other side. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. And I would like to call up Jack Dempsey, Lisa Brown, and Tom Wolf. Exciting.
Chair Clem and members of the committee. Jack Dempsey testifying on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch is currently opposed to House Bill 2099 as currently drafted. You've heard some of the background on this issue, and I will let Ms. Brown provide you with most of the details. From my read of this bill, it's very simple in what it's trying to achieve. It overturns a Court of Appeals decision. It tosses out the agreement that was put in place in 2005. It changes the rules that have been in place for over a decade, and rules in which approximately 60 to 70 districts and municipalities have gone through. And it sets up a somewhat new system for a small number of parties, including the defendant in the Court of Appeals case. What we heard in 2016 and just heard today was there were approximately 60 districts and cities that are affected by this. During the interim, we spent a lot of time culling through the data. And I think what we note today is that there are less than 10 that we know for sure that are affected, and another 15 or so that are uncertain, because when the Water Resources Department sent out surveys to ask them, they chose not to return those. So it's a much smaller universe than I think what we know of what it was. So the bottom line on this is a bad bill for our rivers and our fish the way it's currently drafted. And it's bad particularly because there's a compromise that's on the table that I think all parties should consider and look at on this. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Brown.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Brown. I'm here testifying on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon. And the issue at the heart of this bill, even though, you know, it is complicated, but really the issue at the heart of this bill is how does Oregon develop municipal water supplies in a manner that also considers the needs of our iconic salmon and steelhead while also promoting water conservation? And I think as we heard from Senator Roblin and Representative McCune testifying about the resolution, you know, these fish are special, and they do evoke a sense of pride in all Oregonians, and we need to be cautious of how we develop our water when the fish are also at issue. And specifically at issue here are these old municipal water permits that are undeveloped and that were granted decades ago, in some cases a century ago, at a time when there was no consideration for the effect of the diversion on fish. And so now when the cities come in to pull that water out, all of a sudden, you know, there are listed fish in the river, and we need to sort of share the water. And the 2005 compromise bill, House Bill 3038, I want to address, it did provide longer timelines for new municipal permits, which was what was at issue in the Coos Bay North Bend case. It gave the cities the ability to develop these old undeveloped permits, which was at risk. But the compromise was that the permits would be developed in a way that maintains the persistence of listed fish and implements water conservation. So that, I just want to clarify that the fish persistence standard is in House Bill 3038. It was not just a floor statement. So it is in House Bill 3038. You can see it there in this bill under ORS 537-232 sub C. So that was in the House Bill 3038. And what happened is when the city of Cottage Grove intentionally delayed the processing of its extension application while it doubled its diversion in order to then say, we don't have to do anything for the listed fish and we don't have to do a water management conservation plan, Water Watch sought review, and the Court of Appeals affirmed that that was not consistent with how these standards were supposed to be applied. So that's the history of that case. And this is the third year in a row that we find ourselves here discussing the same proposal to now just exempt diversions up through 2013 from the salmon and water conservation requirements. And this is despite many, many hours of hard work by Water Watch, League of Oregon Cities, Special Districts of Oregon, the Water Resources Department, under skillful facilitation by Senator Roblin's staff, that came up with the compromise of using the date 2005 to define the undeveloped portion of the permit. That is the date that the bill passed, House Bill 3038, and it addresses the city's concern of this sort of clawback or sort of retroactive conditioning back to the 90s. So when the bill passed in 2005, it had the fish persistence standard in there. Everybody was aware of that, and we came up with that compromise, Senate Bill 971 in 2015, which some interests later blocked from passing, and we find ourselves here again. And I think, you know, the good news is that through the work group convened on the basis of Chair Clem's letter and by the governor's office, you know, we're in a much better position this year to understand sort of what the different proposals do. There's been a lot of additional data generated through the work group and especially through the hard work of the Water Resources Department, who I want to thank for doing that. And it's clear that more permits have moved through the system successfully, and that many more than that are just simply not affected, mostly because they haven't, they either haven't diverted any water under the permit or they diverted it before the permit expired. So we believe that there is a solution within reach here as the number of permit holders continues to shrink and the specifics become more clear. And, I mean, for example, City of Philomath, who's been used as an example here, their permit expired in 1993. They pulled some more water through the system by 2005, but they haven't diverted anything in addition after 2005. So under a 2005 date, City of Philomath and several others that are similarly situated do not have any effect from the court opinion. I would also say that of the permits that the Water Resource Department has identified as being affected, a number of them, which is approximately 8 or 10, depending how you define that, a number of those are small cities that have, you know, where there's less than one CFS or less at issue. And, you know, we're certainly interested in trying to find a practical solution for those small cities. City of Detroit, for example, there's 0.36 of a CFS at issue. I think we should all be able to find a solution there. I do want to talk briefly about the issue of cleaning up the system and fairness. And we can use City of Sandy as an example here because they've, you know, because you've heard something about their situation already. So their permit expired in 1996. According to the department's spreadsheet, which is based on information that City of Sandy provided, they then applied for an extension in January of 2016. So their permit lapsed for 20 years, and during that time, they diverted some additional water. According to their survey, they diverted the additional water between 2014 and 2016. So this does get to the issue of the need to clean up the system where we have these permits in these very lapsed situations. And I think nobody anticipated when the bill was passed that you would have these long periods of time where cities would not file for an extension application. And because by rule and statute, that should have happened in the case of City of Sandy by 1997. You get basically 1 year. So, you know, I think nobody anticipated that there would be these, you know, permits that were so lapsed, and that has created some of the, I think, confusion here. So I guess I would just close by saying that we are optimistic, Water Watch is optimistic, that, you know, with the work that has been done in the work group, that with a little more work, we can find a solution that, you know, provides enough water to meet the city's needs while also considering the needs of salmon and promoting water conservation. So.
Chair Clem, committee members, for record, my name is Tom Wolf here, representing the members of Trout Unlimited. And just for context, 25 years ago when I started with Trout Unlimited, we had 300 members here in the state of Oregon and 30,000 nationwide. Now we have 3,200 here in Oregon and 155 nationwide. And I'd like to believe that many of the efforts that I've done helped led to that. But one of the things, as we've grown basically from a fishing group to a conservation group full of fishermen. And one of the issues that we've discovered is really important is in-stream flow. And House Bill 2099 concerns that, and I'm here to testify against it in a measure reluctantly because I understand the needs. I live in Hillsborough. Certainly I understand the needs of water. We've grown in the almost 30 years that I've been there from 20,000 people to over 100,000 people. At one time we were the 34th
fastest growing town in the United States. And I used to be surrounded by farmland. I'm now surrounded by shopping malls. I wish I had the farmland back. But I think that the effort behind House Bill 2099 is sincere, but fish persistence, making sure that there's enough water for fish is important, because as we continue to grow, and Oregon will continue to grow, it's a great state that people want to move to, we have to make sure that the laws that we have include laws to protect water quantity for fish. And that has to be important. There's a report, and unfortunately it probably didn't get to you yet, that I've submitted along with my testimony, which unfortunately both of those were late, from done by NSIA through Dean Runyon in 2013, that shows that the fishing industry in Oregon brings into Oregon's economy every year over $1 billion. And an important part of protecting fish to make sure that our fishing industry continues to grow, bring money into the state, not only for direct jobs, but for hotels and restaurants in rural Oregon, is to protect the amount of flow for fish. And Lisa did an excellent job, as she always does, going those parts, so I'm not going to get into it. But I'm just saying that we need the House Bill 2099, whereas it is sincere, is not the answer. I believe that the answer is in the work group that Lisa referred to. I think that we can come to a solution that will be mutually beneficial to all parties. We don't need to, and I know that I'm going to be disagreed with by many people here, we don't need to do it through a bill. We need to continue with that work group, continue to hammer out a solution. And Trout Unlimited is willing to contribute a staff, not me, because I'm not a water guy, I'm a fish guy, but we have living in Salem now a smart lawyer named Chandra Farrar, who used to work on water issues in California, and I'm certainly going to volunteer her use, because she's not here, to be involved in this issue, and I know she wants to. So we're willing to help in any way we can to come to an agreement that deals with this, so that the cities get what they want, but fish get what they want also. And I'll just close. In 2011, I was testifying before the House Energy and Environment Committee that Representative Vic Gilliam was co-chair at the time, back when we had the 30-30 split in the House. And as I was testifying, he and I had a really good relationship, and he thought I was thoughtful, and I thought he was thoughtful. And he said to me later on, he says, "Why are the conservation groups always saying no to everything, and why are you stopping common sense solutions?" I says, and I've thought about that long and hard in the 6 years since he said that, and I don't want to be a group that says no, but I also don't believe that House Bill 2099 is the answer. I believe that the work group that Lisa's involved with, all the other groups that are involved with, the Water Watch is involved with, that I pledge to you to be involved with, will be the answer, that we can come out with a solution that will make sure that all the cities get the water they need as we're growing in this great state that I love dearly, but that we can also protect the needs for fish in the streams. I think we can come out with a solution, and TU, is Trout Unlimited, is pledged to work on that solution. Thank you.
Questions? Vice Chair McLean.
One of the comments that you made, Lisa, that I thought was interesting was the fact that it was on Sandy to not have, I think it was Sandy, example, that it was up to them to come back for an update on their permit. And my understanding, if it's 20 years, you know, you would think that the agency that was in charge of those permits would have at least had contact with Sandy on, you are not in compliance, or you are not in the queue to get a permit. So I'd really like your reaction to that, because to me there's two issues. We've got this issue with what's the year on the right number for the fish persistence, but also we've got an issue on process. And I don't understand how an agency is in charge of permitting lets these folks go for 20 years.
So, mm-hmm. Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, that's a great question. And I can't recall the contents of the City of Sandy's permit file exactly, but I can tell you that most of these cities that get into that situation have received by now several letters from the department saying, maybe they received a letter in the late 90s saying, hey, your permit expired and you either need to file a claim of beneficial use and say we're done developing the permit, we need a certificate, or we've abandoned the permit, or we will file an extension application in 90 days. And then these letters also say, if you don't take one of these actions, we may cancel your permit, which is what, you know, the statute provides for. But, you know, I think there could be better follow through on both ends of that equation, because you do see these files where there are multiple letters like that and there's no action taken on behalf of the permit holder. There's also no action, although I think to give credit where credit's due, the department has been working diligently to address some of these. So yeah, but it is the permit holder's responsibility to take action within a year after that C date expires to certificate their permit, or presumably before it expires to seek an extension of time.
We do have the department here too that is available if we. She's nodding, though, so I don't know that for that particular question.
You start shaking her.
But Representative McKeon.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I have a comment.
Okay.
This has been going on a really long time, and yes, I absolutely acknowledge that Senator Roblin and I care deeply about fish, but we also care deeply about our citizens who need drinking water, and it is my hope that out of this, that the right people can get to the table and come to a solution to this so we don't have to drag this through another session. So I am challenging each one of you to put your best feet forward on both sides of this issue and get this thing resolved so we can have some certainty in what's happening with our municipal water districts.
Yeah, agreed.
Representative Power.
I think I would just also add a comment following up on Representative McCune's. I appreciate how important and how critical municipal water supplies are to growing communities. But, you know, we're also talking about permits that once issued and finalized are going to be irrevocable and in place possibly for decades or centuries. So I would be very interested in working on the issue this session to see if we can bring groups invested in this conversation to fruition and figure out what we can do for these 25 municipalities that seem to be in limbo.
Rep. Rock Smith. Thanks, we still have two more people to testify, by the way.
Okay.
And another legislator here to talk.
No, it's just Representative Johnson. Mr. Landauer mentioned that of course, you've been negotiating this for quite some time, and that they gave you a counter proposal that's sitting on your plate now. What is in it that isn't satisfactory?
Chair Clem, Rep. Smith, let me remember the details of that. I think that it basically would. So we had offered, hey, on this water that was diverted between 05 and 2013, instead of putting fish persistence conditions on there, maybe we could have a menu of required water conservation measures with a target, you know, a goal of, say, 20% reduction in water use, which all cities have those kind of menus in their water management conservation plans. You know, like every other day lawn watering and no washing your car with a garden hose on the street. And I think the counter proposal, and we also wanted those conservation measures to reach whoever was using water under the permit. So a lot of cities are selling water to other cities. So we said, well, whoever's using water under that permit should apply those conservation measures. So I think the counter proposal was that the conditions would only apply to the permit holder, which is an issue for us. And then secondly, that it would basically be this bill using the 2013 date. Mark can shake his head if I'm getting this wrong. Using the 2013 date, with then if the river flows drop below the flows identified as needed to maintain the persistence of listed fish, which is identified by ODFW, that the city would then do a sort of a voluntary call for conservation, but there wouldn't be any sort of required conservation measures. And in our experience, depending on the city and depending how those messages are delivered, that's not, it's not an assured way to meet those salmon flows. So we had some concerns about that. Do you want to speak to that, Jack?
Yeah, I was just going to say that that proposal and counterproposal, just so you understand the timing, have occurred within the last month, so February. So those are still being bantered around and would welcome, as Representative Power said, continued conversation on this.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's a, there's sort of a solid idea, like, kernel that we're kind of going back and forth on there. So I would say that. But yeah, we just, I think we only got theirs within the last week or week and a half. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And let's get the, our other two on the base bill. And then we're going to have Representative Johnson tell us about another amendment that he's got. So Doug Riggs, Steve Caldwell, and Representative Johnson, do you want to all come up together? I don't want to confuse people until we're done on the base bill, if we can. Okay. Is that okay?
That's fine. Okay. Yeah. You're on the base bill?
No, I'm not. So it
on
doesn't
an
really
amendment?
Make sense for me to be here with these gentlemen because
no one
they're,
be up here
I believe,
me.
Politicians and I the water system. So it's a little confusing to me.
He's not a politician.
I like water system.
Okay. Have a seat. For time, it'll be easier if I don't have to then have you walk up all the way again because I don't. You're the last person to testify. So and you're
start.
Here on an amendment?
No. I'm simply here because this is an important issue, and I thought I might have some comments as a manager of a water system.
On the bill that
correct.
We're talking about.
Correct.
Yeah, okay,
yeah.
Great. So, Doug, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Doug Riggs. I'm here on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. We are the nine cities in Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook County, plus Maupin. So we have actually four counties, but only one city in Wasco County. This feels like Groundhog's Day to me. I feel like I've been here before. Mm-hmm. This whole debate makes me feel very old because I was in the building in 2005. In fact, I've been in the building since 1999. Water is one of the main issues that COCO focuses on. We have focused on flows and stream restoration and municipal use and trying to improve the situation in our basin, and we've had great success. As a result of the bills that many of you have helped us with over the years, we have almost quadrupled the flows in the middle of Deschutes around the Bend area. We're working on a habitat conservation plan. We have worked on efforts to restore Wyches Creek. My cities have funded piping and mitigation and conservation efforts. So I will not take a backseat to anyone on river conservation and fish. I want to echo Senator Roblin's testimony and just say ditto. This is really a very simple bill. This is about what we were told would happen when this bill was under consideration in 2005. And I was in the room, I was in the negotiating sessions. It was not a pleasant set of discussions. It lasted for months. I lost all my hair in that session because I had another big water issue where we had to overturn an appeals court decision. And water was my life that entire session. And I was in the room when fish persistence came up, and I will agree with Water Watch that fish persistence is in the bill. There isn't any debate about that. But we were assured that for any permit, any city that had in good faith submitted applications prior to 2005, that those conditions would not apply. Now, that is not to say that other protection measures don't apply. And cities and water districts and everybody else is very interested in protecting flows to the extent that we can. Remember, municipal use is about 6% of the water in the state. So even if we had no municipal use, we alone cannot restore flows in every single river. So we have to be partners with other entities. But there are plenty of other provisions that protect fish, protect flows that existed prior to 2005. So by saying that persistence of fish does not apply to all the ones that were prior to 2005 or submitted prior to 2005 does not mean anything about, you know, a lack of protection for fish. What it does say is that we were given assurances in that room and by the senator who's been quoted, because I talked to him directly, and the House members, that any permit application, any process that had begun before 2005 would not have to comply with those particular provisions. Then we got into a court case. Someone was taken to court. It took a long time to resolve. And so this is not about changing the rules. This is about keeping the rules the way the rules were prior to that period in time. So I think that's my main point. I mean, Senator Roblin could not have said it better. This is about transparency and fairness. No city in this state wants to drain rivers or eliminate fish or not have good flows. You know, cities are people. Cities are citizens. And the citizens of my cities are environmentalists and conservationists and fishermen and rafters, and they all believe that the Deschutes ought to flow at a high level as much as possible, and they believe that Wyches Creek should be restored and fish should be restored above the PG Round Butte Pelton project. So we feel very strongly about that. But what the bill is about is keeping the rules the way they were when these projects were in the pipeline, that we already had a huge backlog, you know, 1.10-year backlog on some of these things. And so our cities had applied. They were in the pipeline. This bill came along. We agreed to it, and we supported it in the end. We've said this is what it's going to be going forward, but it won't be retrospective. So I hope I've helped a little bit with that. But again, this was a very long and difficult debate in 2005. We thought we had agreed on a solution. We agreed to persistence of fish. I didn't like it. I opposed it. But at the end of the day, COCO supported the bill with persistence of fish in the bill based on the assurance that it would be prospective and not retrospective. So thank you very much.
Okay. And Mr. Caldwell, do you want to make your comments now?
Steve Caldwell, I'm the general manager of Perrydale Domestic Water Association, and we cover a rural area. We have no incorporated cities of any kind within our service area. In our 130 square miles that we cover, we're stretched from the northern border of Dallas to the southern border of Sheridan, east to Lincoln, west to Beale Red Prairie, and we have less than 900 connections serving 2,500 or so people. And this is an area that people used to truck their water in before we came into existence in the 70s. So we're rural. Our revenues are less than $700,000 a year. We have very, very limited money. So for us to have to go back and change things will certainly cause us to do something, which is no more new connections. We have a few agribusinesses that rely on us. One that's a blooming kale chip company, no more water. So what do they have to do? Move or shut down. So we like our water and we want our water. And it's really important for us to maintain the right flows. For fish, I'm a fisherman. I don't know how many of you have had a fishing license in the last 10 years, been in a creek?
Well, most of us have, but okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. But, you know, it's an issue of we spend a lot of time making sure that the water is there for our people today, tomorrow, next year. And so we really, really are paying attention to being good citizens, good stewards of water. And we're not alone. All of the little systems out there are paying very, very close attention. And so are the big cities. This bill, from what I can understand, and I'm not a student of the bill, is something that should go forward. We need water. You turned water on this morning, washed your face, took a shower, didn't think about it. I think about it every day. My phone rings, whatever day it is, whatever hour it is, and off I go. We have 2 full-time employees, 3 part-timers. We don't have extra money. So water conservation plan, I just finished one. the fee to have one of those written, $12,500. Couldn't afford it. Did it myself. Spent 50, 60 hours doing it. It was fun. It was interesting. I probably would have had to spend the same amount of time if I'd had a consultant do it, but I couldn't afford that. The fee to file it, $1,800. Wow. Used to be a couple hundred bucks. To do a plan review, $3,300. Just went up from $600. So the point is, we are all stretched for money, and if we have to go back and rebuild, redo, people are not going to have water. There we are.
Okay. Okay. So, Representative Johnson, you've got a dash two. You're also welcome to make comments on the underlying issue or bill if you want to, or just the dash two, whatever you prefer.
Great. Thank you, Chair Clem and committee members. Great to see you. Yes, I'll make some comments on the general bill, but specifically the dash two amendments, which are very important to one of my communities. House Bill, well, for the record, Mark Johnson, House District 52. House Bill 2099 provides a necessary fix to the 2013 Court of Appeal decision that placed retroactive conditions on certain municipal water permits. Two of those impacted communities are located in my district. You already heard from the mayor of Sandy, and I also want to talk to you about the city of Hood River. Senator Thompson and myself sat down with both cities this past fall to better understand their need for a legislative fix to the 2013 court decision. Both communities stand to lose some portion of their water supply that they have been relying upon for many years if we do not pass a bill to provide them with the needed certainty and to avoid the retroactive conditions that resulted from the court decision. I have specifically introduced the Dash 2 amendment language as it came to my attention that the bill, that's House Bill 2099, as introduced, would still result in Hood River having their water supply reduced when they have made significant investments to put that water to future use. You see, the city of Hood River began design work in 2001 for a new water transmission line. The total cost of this project was about $25 million. The city constructed phase one starting in the spring of 2010. Phase two began in the spring of 2011, and the final phase of construction started in the spring of 2013. The problem with House Bill 2099 as drafted is that the construction was not complete until May of 2014. Which means that the bill would not protect the full investment made, as it indicates any water developed after December 11th of 2013 is subject to fish persistence conditions regardless of investments made to put that water to use. Keep this in mind now. The city carefully sized, they engineered, they designed, secured financing for, and constructed a piping system that could handle the full capacity of their permit. They had no reason to believe that when they initiated that construction, nor did their financiers, I would also talk to you about some heavy federal financing here. They had no reason to believe that when they initiated that construction, that there would be retroactive conditioning of the water. They initiated design of the project before fish persistence was adopted in the statute. They had no reason to believe that the 2005 legislation would retroactively apply to their water supply. In addition, they started and completed construction of infrastructure to support the use of their water before the court decision in 2013. What I want you to keep in mind and try to visualize, and maybe Chair Clem, you from your local knowledge, you would appreciate this, but what we're talking about here is a spring that's on it's up on below Mount Hood, just below Lost Lake. You can picture that area on the west side of the amazing, bountiful piece of water that some genius of founding fathers back in the turn of the century found this spring. And that had been the source for Hood River forever for the main municipal supply, but it was supplied with a wooden pipeline, okay? I think you guys have seen some of these wooden pipelines, large, about this big. You got metal, you know, straps to hold this thing together. I can remember as a kid growing up in town, as a line comes into Hood River back in those days, where we used to go play in the water that would be gushing out of these because of the holes. I mean, woods, obviously, you know, was the best they had in the day, but that's what the municipal supply for the city of Hood River was up until the time we began this. And I don't know what the story is or what the quantities were of lost
water just because of an antiquated supply. But it's been a nightmare for the city of Hooter for years, going around, you know, like Keystone cops trying to pound little, just, you know, wooden plugs into this pipe that's leaking like a sieve. So that's what led to this effort to replace it. And they replaced it with a pipe, a beautiful big 24-inch plastic pipe that is sized to utilize the full capacity of their water right. Well, right now, if you look at the bottom of the pipe, they're using maybe a quarter of this right now, because that's all of the spring that they're actually needing at the current time to meet demand. But the pipe was sized to utilize the full water right that they have had in place forever. Our local governments need certainty when they make investments of taxpayer dollars. Retroactively reducing available drinking water supply is not good policy. We should be working to ensure that our citizens have an adequate supply of drinking water for the future. This bill and the Dash 2 amendments are very, very important for maintaining our vibrant economy in Hood River. We have a lot going for us in the Gorge and boast some of the lowest unemployment and growing economies in the state. And that is all in jeopardy without this bill that is before you today. So, Chair and committee members, I just want you to know I have been a part of the work group that has been meeting throughout, leading up to this session as well. And my unbiased opinion would be that the work of that work group is done. I don't believe there's room for further compromise. Frankly, Water Watch's suggestion for a compromise would be what I would characterize as rolling brownouts, where on a given day, where if there was a level of somewhere within the drainage, if there was an issue with water flow, as we'd have to direct our municipal customers to begin cutbacks. How do you tell somebody that you have water contracts with excess supply to start reducing their supply? And what kind of a drag is that going to be on your economy to have that kind of uncertainty hanging over you? So I really don't believe that there's room for compromise on this. I think we need a date and time, and we can have this issue behind us, as Mr. Rigg has so effectively said. But one larger question in here, and this goes to the larger issue of fish persistence and so forth, and the point's been made that these are complicated issues, but we all have a vested interest in protecting our resource. But keep in mind, this spring is one point source for the West Fork of the Hood River, okay? The West Fork of the Hood River is a tributary that also has met. You have the Middle Fork and you've got the East Fork. You've got three forks that come to create the main stream of the Hood River that flows into the Columbia. Within that drainage system, we have irrigation use and we have municipal use. But we also have some of the most innovative conservation measures that are being employed on the planet. Two of our three irrigation companies that supply our ag industry, our fruit industry in the Hood River Valley, are completely pressurized now. The open ditches are gone. The water is pressurized. The evaporation and loss has been cut in half. Somehow, as we talk about fish persistence issues, we need to look at these issues drainage-wide and not simply focus on one little minute, myopic point and say, because something may be amiss there, the entire system, ecosystem is in jeopardy within a drainage area. So with that, I'll get out of your way. I know you've heard enough about this issue today, but I just want to make sure that you know how important this issue is to my communities, both Sandy and Hood River. And I think, as you heard from other folks, too, who have some really vested interest here as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions for this group? Okay. Thank you very much. That is our public testimony. I will say this. We're definitely, to Tom's point, we're not having another work group past this session. We can have more conversations, but we're voting on a bill in this committee sometime before this committee closes its doors to House bills, one way or the other. I know that you would love to volunteer other people, but some of us actually sat through the last one, and I'm sure none of us really want to go through it again just because you've got somebody, a new guinea pig to throw in the room. So we definitely have a little time here, but not a year. We just got done with a year. And I didn't even go to that many. I'm like barely was participating compared to other people. So I'm probably taking bullets for other people in saying that. Okay. Let's...
Can I speak one more?
Yes, Vice Chairman Klein.
I want to say there's not a them and us here. It's all we. We are Oregonians. We need to use our water wisely, safely, and we need to share it. And so I want to say, Representative McEwen and others, that, you know, we've got to find a solution, and we've got to do it in a way that we're on the same team. So please help us do this. If we've got some time, then let's use it well, because Chair Klim says we're voting on it by the end of the session. So
Senate voted on it already. We pushed the line by asking Water Resources to not do anything for the last year, so they're in legal jeopardy if they just stop doing their job, but we asked for some time. We can't do that for another full session. They will get sued, I'm fairly certain, for not moving forward. Okay. Aaron, your turn finally. You've been waiting forever to come and tell us what a bad idea House Bills 2039 and 2040 are. My bills.
Woo.
And I'm so sorry. I did not realize you had some other mayors here. We're texting them, I think, to see if they can come back. But I didn't realize that, or I probably would have done it in the other order.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle, here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities, I was unaware that he was coming as well. So I would have given you the heads up if I had known. But I do hope his city has submitted some testimony on the record on House Bill 2040.
And I think he's just joined us. Would you like to join us?
Thank you. Sorry.
That's okay. You probably didn't need to hear about all the fish persistence.
Hard to get here that quick.
So we're talking about both 2039 and 2040. You can comment on one or both, please.
Go ahead.
Okay. Again, for the record, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The state land use laws require that annexations be made in compliance with statewide planning goals. It's not surprising. But there are other laws that put sideboards, process requirements, and other rules on annexation in general. So a city can't just annex whenever and however we feel like it. However, to maintain the connection between annexation and our comprehensive land use plans and the expectations of the county and cities that have agreed to an urban growth boundary, we have to do effective annexation. Annexation brings an expectation to the newly annexed territory that a sufficient infrastructure will be put in place to serve that property as it develops. However, it is the normal that the increased property taxes collected in these newly annexed territories, even when they become fully developed, do not cover the cost of providing these services. In addition, when a city's boundary runs into an already developed area that either pre-existed the development of the city or was developed by the county through less dense standards of development, we end up, such as in rural residential exception or marginal lands, we run into another roadblock when it comes to annexation. So the House Bill 2039 related to the island annexation, that's where we're running into that issue of previously developed areas developed by the county that then the city ends up surrounding. There are limitations on what can constitute an island. We can't just cherry stem around with four roads and say, ha-ha, you're an island, and then annex those folks in. In addition, when there is a voting requirement placed in the city, generally within the city charter, there is also a requirement that the folks in that island be part of that election. What House Bill 2039 would do is change how we count those votes. Currently, all the votes go into one cup and we determine what is the majority's opinion, either yes on annexation or no. House Bill 2039 would essentially divide those pools in half and say the city residents have to say yes and the folks in the island have to say yes. And the problem with that is you're essentially providing the island the opportunity to veto any and all annexations of their properties. And that becomes a problem because those folks literally sit inside a city. And those folks enjoy connection to the city through our roads. We generally have an agreement with the county that we're not going to leave those folks stranded and have our police cars stop at the edge of the road. We'll have a mutual aid agreement so that way our police officers will go into the island because it would be pretty bad to say, oh, I'm sorry, you're at the edge of our boundaries. We're going to go ahead and let that burglary be completed. So those folks look like city residents. Their neighborhood looks like a city residence. You can't tell when you've driven in and out of an island unless we're really good at putting up signage, which we're not. It's not a great use of resources. So this becomes very difficult for the city to maintain its responsibilities, and then the county as well then has to reach in for all the services that the city isn't providing by an agreement. So it doesn't make sense, regardless of the size of the island, to change that voting structure because it's all the people that are impacted's vote should count equally. And providing services to an island, roads, sewer, water, stormwater, maybe some sidewalks eventually, but that's generally when they come inside the city, that police protection, those folks cost money. We need to be able to share that tax burden so that everybody who looks like they're in the city is paying the same rate. And this change would significantly hamper our ability to do that. And it would also take us away from the concept of how the city forum should go out in a reasonable process, extend the city within its UGB, and by preventing an island from coming in by allowing those voters to say no and having the final say in the decision means that we then have to look at our UGB very differently, because the expectation is the denser development work will occur through redevelopment within a lot of these county developed areas, because you see larger lot sizes and things of that nature. So in order to follow our expected goals, our UGB requirements, have a buildable land supply that we can actually impact change on, we can't have islands being able to say, no, we've decided we're just going to permanently remain county residents and not pay additional taxes. That's why we oppose House Bill 2039. House Bill 2040, related to extraterritorial services, is complicated largely in part because
Are you here just on 2039?
No, just 2040.
Okay, well, good. Yeah. Okay. I had you sign up on 2039, so I thought, well, maybe we just stay with that for a moment. But if you're here to talk about both, too, then why don't you go ahead and talk about the other one as well, and then we'll have the mayor talk about both.
No problem. And related to extraterritorial services, this bill's language comes out of conversations that Chair Clem and I have had about the difference between the types of services that are at issue. We already have the authority to require annexation in return for these services that are listed in the bill. That's in our inherent authority. We don't have to extend our infrastructure outside of our city limits. We shouldn't, in fact, without these agreements. That's good governance, because once you're investing that level of infrastructure, there really should be an expectation that you are developing at an urban level and therefore should come inside the city. The language regarding the intergovernmental agreements, I think, was a reflection of the conversation that we've had about these urban growth management agreements, which are not necessarily intergovernmental agreements, which is possibly a misconstruence on my side, so I apologize for that. But those intergovernmental, those agreements about how we're going to manage that UGB area are vital for the long-term development of the UGB. And in areas where the counties and cities have sat down and made a plan, we have to respect that plan. And sometimes that plan includes when you provide buildings permits to create new development, not necessarily a remodeling permit, which is something I think completely different. But if you're looking to build a new structure that leads to more density, the county would like that agreement to not remonstrate against annexation, as well as the city. Remonstrating is, of course, objecting, which is part of the process of an annexation. You can go and say, we don't want to be annexed, and that has to be taken into account under most annexation methods. So the counties have said, we're going to have you do the development levels in those UGP areas, and we think that you should also say annex when it comes time to your property, when you're contiguous to the city's boundaries. And that meets with goals 14 and 11's purposes. Goal 14 is about urbanization and creating a UGB and working on how we spread urban in a dense manner within that UGB and only extending our UGB where we have to based on population projections. And goal 11 is the efficient services of public services such as water, sewer, and transportation. What I had preferred at the time that Chair Clem and I had the conversation was to list the services which we can't require that annexation agreement for, because who knows what infrastructure we're going to be laying in the future. But there is a concern that has existed in the past, and I will say that from all of my cities that have reported on these issues, no one says if you're remodeling your bathroom, you have to sign this non-remonstrance. No one says if you want the police to respond to this crime, you have to sign this non-remonstrance. And I could see where that would actually be causing a significant problem. So extraterritorial service extensions have led to some other bills, some other areas of consternation, because we have in the past sometimes extended services without requiring this. We end up with an urban level of development inside the UGB, and then we can't annex these folks because they exist, and why would they want to? That's how we end up with islands. So these two bills taken together and separately really inhibit our ability to effectively expand the urban development in a way that's orderly and makes sense. And the annexation is both removed and part of that land land use process, and by making annexation more difficult for us and not done at the pace that we see fit, makes it difficult for us to actually function and create that urban form that's expected with a UGB. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate your consideration.
Let's have the mayor talk, and then we'll have questions.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. There's a lot of people much smarter than me that will be able to testify to the...
We need your name, too.
Oh, sorry, I'm Mark Gamba. I'm the mayor of Milwaukee. That will be able to testify to the legal ins and outs. And what I hope to do this morning is speak to it on a little more philosophical level. Counties really aren't in the business of providing urban services. That's not their job. That's not what they're supposed to do. They're not staffed at that level. They're not taxed at that level. They just, when they attempt to do it, and they do in many cases, it's generally not done as well as it should be because they are spread thin. You know, every county has a planning staff, every county has an engineering staff, but it's doing work for an entire county and really can't put the level of concentration into a specific urban area that it should be doing. Nor can they, at a county tax level, provide the level of services that people expect when they're in an urban area. So any bill that makes it more difficult to shift an urbanized area into a city or cause, I mean, frankly, I think a useful bill might be something that triggers heavily urbanized areas to either annex or to create their own city, which would then, I know, that's scary.
Off message. That's just one member.
I know, it's off message, but the point I'm trying to make is that when you make it more difficult to annex into a city, it's exacerbating the problem that exists out there, which is that we are providing urban services. The cities are paying into that county, right? And our tax dollars are then being used more heavily in the urbanized non-city areas to provide services that we provide our citizens and that our citizens pay extra tax for. So when you have urbanized non-city areas, the cities are subsidizing them. It's pretty basic math. And so making it more difficult for a city to annex urbanized areas that are contiguous is counterproductive to trying to have functional urban areas. And that's the basic. I submitted a letter that's much more plannerese and gets into details. But I just philosophically, making annexation more difficult is counterproductive.
So if I might just ask, because we all have different cities that we're thinking of when we're talking. I'm thinking of my own district. I'm not thinking of yours. And so what I'm thinking of is an area called Jan Ray where they don't use any city water. They built their own water system with their own money. They don't use any city sewer. They all have septic tanks. They aren't responded to by the City of Salem Police because the police station is down here and the sheriff has multiple spots right by the area. And if anything, the sheriff and the rural fire department, who also services that neighborhood, come into the city more often and actually do work for the city without being necessarily compensated by taxpayers. I think they have some intergovernmental agreement where they work out who went into whose territory more often. So they have a system to share resources, but I think it's typically the county-based providers helping that edge of town just because of where the fire station, police station are located. So when you talk to those people, they find it offensive when someone suggests they're being subsidized because they can't figure out what services you're talking about, except maybe the library, but they also have to pay if they want to use the library. So that's the kind of folks I'm thinking of, whereas I know there are other places where they're on city services, and I don't have any objection to those people being annexed. I won't quite say through whatever means necessary, but the rights of cities to contract, if you're going to be accessing their fixed services that they paid to develop and people are getting the benefit, I don't have a beef with that. It's more these situations where I wish the state was uniform, but it's not. And some cities do things and other cities say, we would never do that. What I'm trying to put in is some safeguards for the bad actors. And in this case, it was my city. And they were I think, overzealously, according to the more recent mayors, responding to a mayor who wanted everybody annexed by any means possible, including cherry stemming, including doing roads, including making fake islands, because she believed in the philosophy of annexation and that that's the way we should serve people. So the tactics didn't really matter to her because it was the right thing to do from a land use planning perspective. Okay, that's not totally illegitimate, except it really angers people who feel like you should use a fair method when you annex, and creating roads all the way around an area. So Aaron's right, that doesn't happen anymore, but guess why? Because several of us authored bills in my first session to make it so the roads could constitute no more than 25% of the island, but cities were doing it. And they were doing it on purpose. I think somebody may know about a city in Beaverton whose mayor might be her father, or a city in Washington County whose mayor might be her father, who I think this was one of the main reasons he got interested in city government. So sometimes the legislature, I feel like, has to be the referee between overreaching cities and cities who are just trying to do a protection on their investment. And that's a philosophical point I come from. And the minutiae of the bills can be debated, but I just want you to understand. There are 13 different methods of annexation. Island is the one that is single combined majorities. And so it's the easiest for cities to use and achieve the outcome they want. I'm not certain that it's the most appropriate, though, when the island is literally like 5,000-6,000 people. I don't think that's what the law was meant for. But I know it's easier to use island because those folks are counted in a combined majority. If you use annexation plan, which is probably the more appropriate method, they're in a combined majority. Island annexation, they're in a combined majority. If you move island to a double majority, it will be very difficult to achieve the victory that cities want, and I get that, but that's my perspective, is that use annexation plan method, not island annexation, if you want to bring in a whole lot of people. I don't want to dominate the conversation. So
we're ready to move on to work sessions.
We don't have any work sessions.
We have two.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I did not pay attention to that. Okay. Do you want to respond?
No. You're welcome to. I have heard of such tales. That's not how Milwaukee behaves. We've been very slowly annexing properties as they come tap into our sewer system. We have a large UGMA, Urban Growth Management Area, that in agreement with Clackamas County. We're actually renewing that agreement as we speak. And it's both in Clackamas County's interest and in our interest to eventually be servicing those folks for all of the services that they require, planning, engineering, road building, maintenance, all that kind of stuff, rather than the county trying to do it on their limited funds. And according to my planners, this particularly 2040 would make that many more hoops that much more difficult to cause that to happen. But we're not in the business of trying to force people into our city. We just don't want it to be really hard to do when it is
time comes.
They're interested in being in the city as well.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming down, too. I'm sorry for making you wait through the fish persistence. I didn't realize you were here.
That's all right.
Okay.
No worries.
Let me close the public hearings on House Bill 2039 and 2040. Open a work session on House Bill 2515. This is Representative Gomberg's bill about the historical research to allow access to these cemeteries.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2515 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 2515 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, move that. Let Representative Gomberg carry his zombie bill and open a public work session on House Bill 2516.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2516 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McClain moves House Bill 2516 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, pass. And Representative Gomberg will carry the Honda Cemetery Bill. And with that, I'll adjourn the committee. I forgot there were works. I get so excited about annexation.
That was fun last night.
About annexation.
That was fun last night.
Works. I get so excited.